It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. You know, occasionally you can point to one person and say, they took a great risk, were laughed at, yet because of them, today there is excellence for many. Winemaker David Lett is one of those people. He's the father of Oregon's great Pinot Noir wines. He invited us into his home, and you're going to hear his story. T-Man Bill Waddington invites us to taste the discoveries from his latest trip across the Pacific, teas never seen before in America. Then it's a taste of Japan in New York. We get the insider's finds of Japanese izakayas. Now, these are the traditional bars where you eat special snacks and sip sake, and you have to know where they are since many have no signs at all. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column for Gourmet Magazine. Hey, guys, wait, what's the latest discovery?
The latest discovery is that New England isn't the home of all the great ice cream in America. And we know this because we have been eating ice cream in Berkeley, California, at a little place called EC, I-C-I, meaning here, and also maybe meaning icy because it is ice cream. And this is a place where they make ice cream that is, I would say, truly aristocratic. At first lick, you know there's something absolutely different and superior about this ice cream.
Let me give you some of the flavors. And as the sign above the Cyclone roller coaster on Coney Island used to say, hold on to your car keys and wigs because you're just going to die when I tell you these flavors. Mocha salted almond, Earl Grey and cookies, sesame praline, branded cherry, peach habanero sorbet, molasses ginger snap, and on and on and on. And, you know, you could listen to it and say, the heck are the Sterns doing there? But it is absolutely worth the trip.
Well, it sounds, I must say, for you two, it sounds terribly, shall we say, yuppie, as opposed to sleeves up.
But it's ice cream, you know, the bottom line.
It's so good that if it is yuppie, I don't care. I mean, the thing is, once you taste this stuff, I mean, you cannot resist it. It's so good. And, you know, the place itself is... there is nothing at all fancy about it. There are a couple of window seats, but basically it's all stand-up eating. There's almost always a line to get in. And what's really great about it is that when you get to the head of the line, the server will give you the opportunity to taste anything and everything you want to taste before you actually commit
to a
single flavor.
Which, honestly, I can't stand because I'm so type A that it's like, hurry up, find a flavor you like,
Jane,
and get the hell out of here.
No, Jane, you're missing one of the great opportunities of life to be able to sample a little bit of everything.
But there should be like a separate line. There should be like an annex for people who can't decide what they want.
But Michael, you said this was aristocratic. Now, granted, I must say this flavor sound fabulous, but what is it about the ice cream that sets it apart? Just those great-sounding flavors?
Well, the flavors are great, but what to me makes it aristocratic is that it isn't simply a matter of high butterfat content. You know, there are a lot of deluxe ice creams where the butterfat content is so high it's almost like eating sweetened butter, which to me is kind of nauseating. I mean, it's rich ice cream, but not sickeningly so at all. I mean, what to me is so great about the ice cream is that the flavors are so vivid. You know, it's not just the echo of a flavor like you get in so many others. I mean, when you taste Santa Rosa plum-flavored ice cream here, you just are tasting plums infused with the flavor of cream. And, you know, what's better than that?
Oh, gosh.
You know what
good.
I loved about EC or Icy is when you get an ice cream cone, they dabble chocolate into the bottom pointy part of the cone.
Right.
So when it's kind of like a lagniappe, you know, at the end of the cone, you think, oh my God, you couldn't get any better. And there you have a mouthful of wonderful chocolate.
And it doesn't drip out the bottom.
No, because it's the last bit.
So where in Berkeley is this?
It's on College Avenue. It's in the heart of Berkeley. And One of the things I also have to say about it, which again is not maybe typically Stern stuff, is that the place is absolutely virtuous in terms of keeping the earth green. The tasting spoons that they give you are made from potato starch, so they're biodegradable. The wrappers on their ice cream sandwiches are biodegradable. The bowls that ice cream is served in, if you get a bowl of ice cream, is made from material derived from sugarcane fibers.
Can you eat
Yes, this is exactly what came to me.
I didn't
eat the spoon.
The spoon and bowl do not look edible to me. I didn't try. I was too busy with
Michael,
the ice cream.
I think you're going over the line a little bit here.
I just want to say it's a very virtuous place.
It's a very virtuous place, exactly. Yeah.
Well, thank you for the virtue, guys.
Goodbye.
The Sterns go green. Bye.
I can give you what you want. I can make your heart beat short. I can make you ice cream. We could be a sweet tea melting in your vice dreams, sport.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. You know how. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. We got a question in the mail. A listener wrote that she bakes a dessert once a week, but she was starting to think that she was lighting this big oven for just one dish and wasting an awful lot of energy. She wanted to know what she could do about it. Well, think about this. You could do a whole week's worth of cooking in that one oven all at the same time. For instance, let's say your brownies bake at 350 or 375 or even 400. At any of those temperatures, you could also roast a chicken, roast a mess of vegetables, bake a bunch of sweet potatoes in their skins, and bake apples. Now, keep it simple. Don't get carried away with cutting things up or fancy dance seasonings. You can do all of those things if you want when you actually eat the dishes. So once the dishes are done, you store the foods in the fridge. And then you flavor them as you take them out all through the week. For instance, the cold sweet potatoes are dynamite seasoned with cinnamon, pepper, and balsamic and heated in the microwave. The chicken's going to be good hot or cold for several nights. The roasted vegetables are great as a salad. But then again, you could do a stew. You heat them up with broth and beans and season however you feel like. One oven filled with whatever you can fit, and you're done. Tea merchant Bill Waddington goes to the sources of the teas that he carries. Now, even though he's been studying tea for two decades or more, he's always coming up with new information and new discoveries. Bill's the creator of the Tea Source Shops in Minnesota. Bill, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
Now, Bill, a while ago, you brought us some very special teas, the teas that tea families usually keep for themselves. So what have you got this time?
We've got two teas in the same vein, and they're both made by families and both regional specialties. I'm going to start on brewing right now. One of them is called Blue Beauty Oolong.
Oh, the name alone is worth it's worth the trip, as they say.
It is a great tea. The other one is a white tea, and white tea is still all the rage right now, but it's unusual in that it's a white tea from Assam, India, and as far as I'm aware, the only white tea made in Assam, India.
What is a white tea?
A white tea basically is the raw, unprocessed leaf of tea. The only thing that's done is a little bit of drying, what they call firing, to the leaf so that some of the moisture leaves the leaf so it won't mold and break down. But it's almost the raw, unprocessed leaf. Very light flavor, very subtle, soft, sweet notes to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's traditionally made just in the Fujian Mountains of China. And actually, there's a huge argument going on in the tea world. The same argument that went on over champagne.
Right.
If white tea is made somewhere else other than these two villages in Fujian province, is it really white tea or not? Well, this family in Assam, India says it is, and it's a beautiful hand-processed tea.
Okay, you're taking these out of the package, and they're on a white piece of paper. These could be herbs.
You can see the whole leaves. We call this tea a leaf and a bud. Because there's that old expression in the tea business, the top two leaves in the bud are the best leaves for flavor. And you can see the entire intact leaf.
They're not rolled up in any way. They're just dried leaves with a teeny, teeny bit of stem. But the aroma, it almost smells a little bit like vanilla.
Oh, I can see that. Yeah. It has a little sweet. Some people get a little buttery note from the flavor.
Yeah. Which tea is this, Bill?
That is the white tea from Assam, India, the leaf and a bud.
Now, what would you like me to taste first?
We're going to taste the white tea first. There we go. You could hear the timer go off.
All right.
We're going to decant the tea.
So you've got a little white cup with a lid, mm-hmm. and it has a soft tooth edge so that after the tea is brewed in the cup with the lid on, you pour and the leaves stay inside of the cup, and it now is going into a small tea bowl. Mm. Now, can I smell the teas that has the tea? These are the leaves that have brewed. Oh, but still, they're very subtle. There's, for me, I'm smelling fruit and a hint of vanilla. Okay, now, the tea itself is very pale. It's just like a pale, 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 pale straw color.
Mm-hmm.
Very subtle.
Very light, very subtle.
Fruit. I mean, there's a hint of fruit, almost peach-like or apricot-like. There's almost a sweetness, but this is so subtle.
It is very light. People have been drinking dark black teas for a long time, and they come in and try a white tea. They come up to me later and say, Bill, it tasted like water, just warm water. And what I'd encourage them to do is drink green teas for a couple of weeks, kind of readjust your palate, then try a white tea. It is the softest of all teas.
And I drink black tea a lot. You know, I mean, I'm at the other end of the spectrum. I drink it with milk and sugar.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things I love about this tea is the leaf is so gorgeous. In Asia, the teas are appreciated for the aesthetics of the look, of the beauty of the leaf, as much as they are for the flavor. And this is one of the most beautiful hand-processed leaves I've ever seen.
They're beautiful. They are beautiful, and there, many of them are just whole. Okay, what's the next tea?
The next tea is a tea. It's an oolong tea from the Fujian province, the mountains of northern Fujian province in China. I've never seen it anywhere else except for a little tea shop I stumbled across this tea in Hamburg, Germany. And then I spent about 3 years trying to figure out what the heck it is and where it came from.
All right, now this tea looks like little rolled up. I'm looking at the leaves that have just been taken from the brew pot, the little brew cup. And these look like little rolled up leaves. They still have a dark green color. Oh, in their dry state, they're like little nuggets. And they smell like sweet barley and nuts. Oh, they really smell like nuts. So they're an oolong tea, which means?
Which means it's not as strong as a black tea. It tends to have a little bit more mm-hmm. body than a green tea.
Okay, so this is now a darker color, slightly darker liquid.
And they've added something to the tea in this particular traditional tea. So it's not 100% tea. They've added something as part of the tradition in the region this tea is from.
I just got one of the nuggets. No, but I'm chewing it.
Okay.
And it's very weedy. You know what this tastes like? This tastes like the sweet water that you get when you cook barley.
Oh, so that sweet note is coming through.
The sweet note is coming through, but also almost a hint of mint. What am I drinking?
You're drinking an oolong tea
right.
that's blended with a little bit of ginseng and a little bit of licorice root.
The licorice is what's on my tongue.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
And they roll it into these almost nuggets of tea.
And so this is only from this one small part of China?
Only made in this one little tiny region of China.
Fascinating. Hey, Bill, thank you.
It's been fun, Glenn. Thanks.
Bill Waddington owns the Tea Source Shops in St. Paul, Minnesota. Now, you can find Bill's tea discoveries on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, and information on our new book designed to get you to sit down and eat well with friends and family. It's called How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. And you're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Papa Pino and the Japanese culinary hideaways of New York City. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. There was a time when if you told a wine expert that there were going to be superb Pinot Noirs, or any other wine, coming out of Oregon, he would have laughed you out of the room. Well, you probably know that today those wines are compared to the great Burgundies of France. One man started this off in the Willamette Valley. In 1966, David Lett did what was thought to be insane. He and his new wife, Diana, spent their honeymoon planting the first Pinot Noir grapes in the valley and the first Pinot Gris grapes in all of America. They were creating their Irie vineyards, which now, 40 years later, holds cult status. Now, I've wanted to meet David for a long time. This man has a reputation for being a firebrand, a stubborn traditionalist in winemaking, and of course, a prime visionary. Well, after all the success in the wine world, the Letts still live in a real house, not a Tuscan manse. It's tucked into the vineyard. Those first grapes that they planted in the 60s are right outside the living room door. His wife, Diana, greets us in the garden and leads us into the living room where David is seated in a chair. His health has been failing of late, and he's tethered by an oxygen tank, but he has lively, spirited eyes. His son, Jason, the current Irie winemaker, pulls up a chair and joins us. David, going back to those days when you were studying at University of California at Davis, which is, I always think of it as it's sort of the Harvard of wine. What were you drinking back then when you started to fall in love with Pinot Noir? Because we're talking the 60s, right? The early 60s.
Yeah, there were very few Pinots in California. So the curriculum was primarily based on French Burgundy. And that was my introduction to Pinot Noir, and that's what turned me on to Pinot Noir. They were ethereal. It evoked so much in yourself that it was truly an exciting wine to drink. And this was back in the days when Pinot Noir was made quite differently in Burgundy than it is now. Thank God. It was a nice wine. They're messing around with it a little too much in Burgundy these days.
So what you're emulating here are those wines that you were drinking early on, those ethereal, soul-touching, if I could coin a phrase, wines.
I am trying to. But I've stuck to what I started with, and that is a Burgundian ideal of the 1960s.
You came here in 1966, and you planted Pinot Noir grapes. And you came here from California. You could have, in those days, gone anywhere with those grapes. Why did you pick Oregon?
Because I wanted to make the great American Pinot Noir. And I figured there was no climate cool enough in California to do that.
When did you bottle your first vintage?
1970.
Now, was it in 1975 that you entered the Pinot Noirs into a tasting in France? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes.
Jason,
vintage, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
I can help with some of the dates here. The vintage that was submitted was the 1975.
I see.
But
the
year was 1979.
And what happened with that tasting?
It was amazing. We were in competition with a number of fine Burgundies on the first competition.
Mm-hmm.
And then Robert Drouin called a second competition, and we did even better. We placed second. I think Oregon was made then.
Drouin was a very famous maker of Burgundy.
Yes.
And he called that second tasting, why? Because you had done so well in the first and he wanted to disprove it?
That's right. Huh. Right on.
So what happened after this second tasting? What happened here? Did you suddenly have a market for your wines that you hadn't had before?
You're very incisive, yes.
But what was it like for you, personally?
Oh, I was dancing in the driveway. It was fantastic.
I've been told that this may well be the most difficult grape to grow, that it's called the heartbreak grape. I mean, it seems to be such a strange choice for someone beginning in the business, making his first wine himself, and choosing a grape that's so demanding.
Well, that was the fun part. Really was. Diana and I were talking a few months ago, and she said, "What would you do if you had this to do all over again?" And I said exactly the same thing. I'd do the same. It was fun. I was starting something new, and I enjoyed it.
What were the biggest challenges with that grape here?
Jason?
Every vintage is a new challenge. That's one of the great things about growing Pinot Noir. It's really expressive of vintage and of the person who makes it and of the place where it's made and, every sort of nuance that goes into growing that grape.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole new set of challenges every year, and that's what makes it so fun.
Were there out-and-out failures? I mean, did you have years where it was just impossible for you?
There was 1984, and that was supposed to be an out-and-out failure. Most people didn't even make Pinot Noir that year.
Uh-huh.
They turned it into rosé or something. And I stuck it out and made a red wine out of it, and it's delicious today.
We just had a tasting of every vintage we've done, all 37 vintages. And many of the people at that tasting picked out the 1984 as a favorite from that decade. And so that's a real testament to Dad's ability to adapt to, changing conditions from vintage to vintage.
So the way you make your wine, how do you make Pinot Noir?
Generally speaking, by keeping my hands off of it. I think the grapes are all important. I mean, they're the basis of the expression of the wine. Winemakers can go in and fiddle around and do this and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just going to bugger up the grapes. The best thing to do is leave the grapes alone and let them express themselves under proper growing conditions. We grow good grapes. Jason does a fine job. And he also makes fine wine, which is fortuitous.
I think one of the things that sets our process apart is how intuitive we are. That's certainly what I've learned from him, and that's one of the advantages of being a second-generation winemaker, using the word maker loosely. Is that I can work more intuitively because I've had the experience of working vintages with Dad and seeing the way that he responds to the environment. So I just try to do the same.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see the vineyard.
Absolutely. Well, let's go take a look.
Okay. Jason, I would imagine, did you teethe on a wine vat?
I teethed on a wine cork, that's for sure.
Really? Well, I guess that makes sense.
My kids have too, yeah. my dad used to do a little game with us. He would buy a roll of Lifesavers, and he would hold a Lifesaver in his hand, and we'd have to smell it. And if we could tell him what flavor it was, he'd give it to us. But if we couldn't, he'd eat it.
So how many times did you get it right?
I'm pretty much 100% on Lifesavers now.
So we've got this slope up here covered with vines and the tractor back here that's waiting to do its work. But which vines are these?
These are Pinot Noir vines. And this block here is special to me. It was the last block that we planted at this vineyard. And I got to help do it in 1974. I was 4 years old. And if you look over to the hill beyond, you'll see the original vines, the ones that were planted in 1966.
And of course, they'll produce for a very, very long time yet.
Grapevines are a bit like human beings. As they age, the quality of what they produce goes up, and the quantity goes down. And so these vines will continue to produce fruit probably past their 100th year. And what we're going to continue to see as that process happens is an increase in quality and a decrease in quantity. And we're already starting to see this. This vineyard is giving us maybe a ton and a half to the acre every year, but the flavors are concentrated and gorgeous. And so we'll keep farming this long past the time an accountant would tell me to pull it out.
I like to hear that. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you. Good having you here.
David Lett created his Irie Vineyards in 1966. His son, Jason, is now carrying on the tradition. Now, for more information on their wines, go to the website, splendidtable.org. If you want to know where to eat in New York City, one person to go to is Mike Colomeco. Now, on his daily radio show, Food Talk, he covers the city's food scene from eating on the cheap in Hell's Kitchen to going behind the kitchen doors of great restaurants. Mike spent a lot of time in those kitchens as a chef. Mike Colomeco, it is really good to have you back.
Hey, always a pleasure. So what's the topic on the dais today? What are we doing?
Well, I want to talk about Japanese izakaya places. Now, first of all, I think you got to explain what this means.
Yeah, I'm not sure there is a cultural context that this is going to translate to. But, you know, this is, if I guess some of your listeners might know yakitori, which is that great simple grilled chicken on a skewer. Izakaya, ostensibly, it had been for the longest time sort of Japanese businessmen's bar food. These places were popular, and still are, all around Japan, where the cultures are still, you know, men and women are still a little bit divided, and the guys work those long hours and tend to come out of work in groups out of the office building and then hit these bars where they drink copious amounts of sake, smoke lots of cigarettes, and eat all sorts of funny finger food. Well, there's always been a big Japanese expat community here in Manhattan. And, of course, that's the reason we have so many great sushi restaurants, mm-hmm. why it became so popular mm-hmm. in sashimi. But sort of under the radar was this izakaya, because a lot of the stuff was food that Americans just weren't familiar with. So when I was first introduced to these restaurants, it was always in tow with Japanese hosts who would say, Mike, son, I want to take you to my favorite. Hey, I'm in, you know, take me. And half the time I didn't even know what I was eating. But of course, you know, if you're an omnivore and you're passionate, you're just, if it's good, I'm in.
Yeah, you're going to eat it.
One of the best of this genre is one that you're never going to find. And this is true with a lot of these places, that they have this sort of basement speakeasy quality to them. This one especially, it's called Sakagura, S-A-K-A-G-U-R-A. It's on East 43rd Street, between, I think, 2nd and 3rd. I know it because it's right across from one of the great sushi restaurants in New York, which is Sushi Yasuda. Mm-hmm. And the first time I was there, I had dinner at Sushi Yasuda with Japanese friends, and they said, now we go across the street. And it's a white brick office building that there is no restaurant on. I mean, there's no sign. There's a little plaque on the outside, and it tells you Sakagura. But it could be a dentist office for all I know. No. So you walk in through this little fluorescent lit lobby, literally down the steps into the basement, past the boiler room, past these pipes. It's cinder blocks on both sides. You open a little door, and suddenly there's three contiguous rooms running the length of the building in the back, packed with Japanese. Mostly, 90-some percent. And it's great. Possibly, I think it is, the best sake collection in New York City. Hundreds of bottles of sake available by the glass, mm-hmm. and wonderful, wonderful bar food. And what is this food? Well, it's a mix of sort of finger food. Again, yakitori is part of it, but you'll see dishes with eggs, dishes with tofu. Another one that they call it the tuna collar, where they grill part of the jawbone and it comes out.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really neat stuff. And I think Sakagura is the sort of the big famous one because it has this great sake list to go with it. Another one that's pretty bizarre because they serve raw chicken is Aburiya Kinusuke, which is a sister restaurant. That's in the 50s. There's another restaurant next door by the same owner. You walk up the steps, and he's got lots of the skewer food, but this is the first time I've ever had chicken sashimi.
That sounds a little scary, to be quite frank.
Well, that's what people say, but it isn't. It, you know, if the bird's clean, it's an organic bird. It's great. It's cut from the breast, and it's like butter. And then, look, people that didn't eat fish raw for the first time took a leap of faith. Trust me on this one. It's really fantastic. another one that's downtown, and these are all over. For the most part, you're going to find these midtown in the 40s and 50s, because that's sort of the office community. You know, that's where a lot of the Japanese headquarters are. But these have moved down to the East Village. But another one that still keeps us uptown and is really becoming a super favorite is Hage. And that's on West 49th Street. Again, 150's block in the middle of town. And again, it's one of these sort of basement subterranean cool scenes where I think what I like most about these is there's this otherworldly thing. I mean, we know that New York's kind of cosmopolitan. We know that New York's international. But you walk into these places and you just think you were picked up in Tokyo at the airport, went back to your hotel, right, and a friend of yours picked you, and now suddenly you're just somewhere, some prefecture in Japan, because the crowd is almost 90%+ Japanese.
What about money? Are these expensive? Because I know Japanese food can get pricey.
It isn't. No, they're not. Most of, with almost no exceptions, the plates run in the single digits, and it's kind of, you're not going to go there to eat dinner per se. Mm-hmm. It can turn into a meal, but if it does, you're going to have 6 or 7 of these.
I understand.
So a lot of times you're kind of going because you're not that hungry. Maybe you had a big lunch or you had a lighter dinner and you want to hang out late. A lot of these are late night hangouts, but no, they're great places to have food that you're not that familiar with. Again, lots of Japanese finger food, Japanese bar food, and paired with wonderful sake. And I think just transformative experience, real classic, you know, New York Japanese thing.
Hey, Mike, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Mike Colomeco hosts his Colomeco's Food Show on PBS Channel 13 in New York City. Now, for Mike's Izakaya finds, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what's one source that you don't want to depend on when looking for a restaurant with a great wine list? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the one source that you don't want to depend on when looking for a restaurant with a great wine list? Well, lamentably, the answer is the magazine The Wine Spectator. They give a flock of awards each year to restaurants for excellence in their wine lists. This year, an award for excellence went to a restaurant in Milan called the Osteria L'Intrepido. There's just one hitch. Osteria L'Intrepido doesn't exist. It was made up to test the veracity of the Wine Spectator Awards. Now, here's the backstory. According to a piece in the LA Times by Jerry Hirsch, a wine critic named Robin Goldstein made up L'Intrepido, complete with a website with a street address, a menu, a phone number with an answering machine for reservations, and a fake wine list. He purposely put wines on the list that the Spectator had panned in its published tastings. Why? Well, he wanted to know what was behind wine awards. He found out that restaurants pay $250 each to Wine Spectator to apply for the awards. This year, 4,500 restaurants spent that $250 to apply. Add that one up. This is like $1 million. And the magazine admits that they never visit about 200 of the restaurants that get its awards each year. The Spectator accuses Goldstein of being a publicity hound. But how do you give an award for something that you have had no firsthand experience with? Methinks the magazine has some egg on its cover.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you.
can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
Maybe the lines are open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, we have Tom calling from Huntsville, Alabama. Tom, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I'd like to talk about gyoza.
The Japanese dumplings?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
When I was young, my father was stationed in Japan, and one of the things my mother learned to make from our Japanese friends was gyoza. And it became my all-time favorite food. And
Why don't you explain to listeners what exactly it is?
Gyoza is basically a dumpling. It has a special type of skin, a thin pastry. It's either beef, which is my favorite, or pork, mm-hmm. mixed with onions, cabbage, a little sesame, some soy sauce, depending on taste. That's deep fried. That's the way I like them. Some are boiled, some are pan fried.
Right. Some people just pan sear them and then put water in the pan and cover them.
Absolutely.
That's the way I like them. I like anything fried, but, you know, when I'm trying to be a little bit disciplined.
Oh, absolutely. But remember, I'm in the heart of the South, so we have to pan fry.
I understand. I fully, and nobody fries like a Southerner. I'm sorry. This is a genetic thing. But go on about the question.
Well, it's my all-time favorite food, and my wife's a bit of a vegetarian, and she won't try it because of the meat.
Wait a minute. Tom, that's like saying she's a little bit pregnant. I mean, you're a vegetarian. So
okay,
she's not doing the pork or beef thing, I guess.
She's not too much in the pork or beef
thing. Right.
But precious beyond belief. So I want to find a way to give her a chance to try this without using one of the soy substitute, you know, ground beef or things, you know,
right.
like that. Something that would hopefully capture the same flavor and let her enjoy it like I do. And I'm kind of stumped, and I thought, if there's someone that can answer my question, you'd be it.
Well, it's always so hard to duplicate one thing with another thing.
Right.
But have you thought about mushrooms?
No, I hadn't.
You know, shiitakes, Chinese mushrooms, even porcini, especially if they're nicely browned and, you know, lightly sautéed, and the flavorings go into that.
Okay.
And the other thing, you know, I'm thinking of how delicious cabbage is when you brown it. And, you know, brown it in a little bit of vegetable oil, and then add the seasonings, because that can be fabulous. Now, the cabbage is always cooked before it goes in anyway.
Right.
So why not, instead of boiling it or whatever, why not braise it in a pan where you brown it, you add maybe a little ginger and garlic to that,
okay.
maybe you add a tad of soy sauce, and of course it's chopped very, very small. You might add a little bit of broth
okay.
to it or rice wine. Boil that down, let it get tender, and then that becomes the filling on its own as well. So you can do either, you know, that or that with the mushrooms.
Okay.
Because mushrooms are amazingly meaty. You could even grind up the mushrooms.
I never knew that.
Yeah. I mean, you could cook them and then puree them. Mm. And they could be the texture of the meat. I mean, close to it anyway.
Right.
And then, you know, you could completely go in another direction, which is... I once, now this was in a Japanese restaurant, and I have not been to Japan yet, but I had a sweet potato dumpling, which was done with the cabbage, with all the usual seasonings, but there was a sweet potato, and it was in chunks, and again, I think that was browned as well, and then cooked, or it could have been roasted. But the point was, it was a completely different experience, and it was not a lot. There was more cabbage than... sweet potato. But sweet potato, you know, is much prized in Asia.
True.
And it's a different taste, but it's really delicious.
Very good.
So I think there's three choices, and there's no doubt plenty more. The mushrooms are going to be very meaty. The cabbage can be very meaty tasting, but in a very different way. Mm-hmm. The sweet potato takes you down another whole, you know, path.
Right.
But still has some note of tradition behind it.
Very good.
See what you think.
Hey, I'll give them a try.
Sounds like she's lucky to have you.
Oh, I'm lucky to have her, let me tell you.
Hey, Tom, thanks.
You bet, and enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. Take care. Call us, 800-537-5252.
Okay, we've got an email from Denise in Kalamazoo, and she said, I just spent $20 on a little bottle of white truffle oil, and I know it's a delicacy, but I smelled it and tasted it, and yuck, it is not very appetizing. So do I throw the $20 away? Any ideas? Let me tell you something, Denise. Most of the truffle oil out there, it's white truffle oil from what you say. I'm sorry. The closest a truffle ever got to that was probably saying the word over the bottle. Now, white truffles smell earthy and they smell like garlic. They're really, really pungent. And if you've got a good oil that smells like that, then you drizzle it over things like scrambled eggs, over a potato salad with oil and vinegar on it. It's wonderful on hot corn on the cob or with tomatoes and mozzarella. You know, you can toss it with a little bit of pasta and cheese. Fabulous. But if it smells like the devil and you don't want to put it in your mouth, consider that you've just spent $20 on an education. Sorry. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Nick calling from Sandpoint, Idaho. Hey, Nick, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well.
What we'd like to talk about, we're actually on tour right now with our band, No Cover, my two brothers, Mike and Tim and I.
Uh-huh.
And we have a ridiculous amount of extra firm tofu.
How did you... Now, wait a minute. Okay, so you've got a band. What kind of music do you do?
Like pop rock, kind of like the Beatles and Elton John and Billy Joel.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, but a lot younger. We're all, like, I just turned 20, and we're all in our younger 20s.
Okay, I got it. So now, how did you come by a large amount of firm tofu?
Well, it's a pretty long story, but we have a few different sponsors, uh-huh. And one way or another, we have, like, four different boxes filled of extra firm tofu. So I tried some last night, but it turned out to be a disaster.
What did you try to do with it?
Well, I just put olive oil and just tried to, like, fry it up a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
But it just tasted disgusting, and it really wasn't good, and I burned it. It was a really big mess.
I feel your pain, Nick. I feel your pain. Okay, firm tofu, a couple of things. Number one, marinate it. Take some soy sauce, maybe, you know, I'm thinking typical teriyaki, for instance, which would be a little rice wine or any kind of wine. A little soy sauce, a little sugar, a little ginger, a little garlic. Cut it up into pieces. Drizzle that over it. Just put it in the fridge. Keep it cool. Okay? Then you can pan brown it. And it will have absorbed. Think of the tofu as a sponge. Okay?
Okay.
Because otherwise it's extremely bland. So marinate it any way you want. There's another thing that's done with firm tofu, and this is very... this is the tofu all by itself, almost. In Japan, in very hot weather, they cut it into small bite-sized cubes, and they chill it. They get it very cold. And then what they do is they take a little miso, you know, that paste? I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
And they dilute that with hot water, let that cool, and they just put a little bit of vinegar in that, and they serve that ice-cold tofu.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
So they just make it really cold. They put it in the freezer.
In the fridge, they make it cold as can be. Another way they do it is just serving it with rice vinegar, shaved ginger, and thin-cut scallions. And you just dip it in that vinegar. Or you dip it in the vinegar and you have a little sugar in the vinegar, so it's sweet sour. But it's stone cold. Stone cold. The other thing is you can take soy sauce and vinegar and a little hot chili oil. And use that as a marinade. And then you can take that tofu and just do that pan browning you did. Don't do it with olive oil, though. Do it with a flavorless oil. And that tastes really great.
Yeah, that sounds really, really good.
And the other just basic rule with tofu, you can put it into soups. You can put it into stir fries. Just add it toward the end because if you bounce it around, it breaks up easily.
Wow, well, that sounds great. Thanks so much.
Well, Nick, good luck with the tour. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks so much. Have a great week.
You too. Take care. Call us, 800-537-5252. A long time ago, I made an unpleasant, well, actually, a negative comment about tofu, and I learned that there are very devoted fans of this what we used to call soybean curd. And it has been around for 4,000 years. You should know that. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. How much does hype influence what we think we're tasting? And can we really know what we're eating? In seafood, for instance, it seems the fish con is on. The New York Times did a piece called Fish or Fowl, and after reading it, I decided that the next time I order fish, I'd better do a DNA check first. The piece's reporter, Edward Dalnick, is on the phone. Edward, welcome.
My pleasure.
So what's the story here? What is the con?
Well, it's when one thing purports to be something and is really something else. When your white tuna turns out to be tilapia, that kind of thing.
Aha. And you say in the article that the fish experts are the easiest ones to fool, and that this has been going on in restaurants in New York, right?
It has, but it's not just fish experts who are easy to fool. Any kind of expert becomes puffed up, overconfident, and easy to fool. That's why magicians like know-it-all scientists rather than wise guy five-year-olds, say. It's the experts who are easy marks.
And why is that? Because they make a lot of assumptions?
They think they know so much that they lead themselves astray. If a magician clanks two rings together, a grown-up knows that that means the rings are solid. A child doesn't know enough to leap to that faulty conclusion. In things like wine, if a malicious researcher doctors white wine so it looks red, if you know a lot about red wine, you'll immediately go wrong. If you hardly know anything about wine, you're more likely not to make that mistake.
So interesting. So you're saying a lot of experts are eating a fish, for instance, instead of the rare white tuna. They're eating tilapia, and they're raving over how great the tuna is.
Quite likely. And they actually do enjoy it. It's not that they think it tastes bad and they say it doesn't. It's just as if when any of us goes to a restaurant and the service is elegant and the waiter is attentive and the prices are high, mm-hmm. we're primed to like things, and we really do.
So is there any science behind all of this?
Well, the science is that when we taste things, there's all kinds of complicated chemistry going on, but there's all kinds of complicated psychology, too, because tasting involves your tongue and it involves your mind, and the mind is probably an equal partner in this.
So if you were to blindfold a random group of people and give them different foods to taste, would they be able to identify what each item is?
Well, the look of things is awfully important. So a blindfold would make for big trouble. I wrote about a test with yogurt where people were asked to try a new flavor of strawberry yogurt. And the researchers told them that they wanted them to concentrate so much on taste that they were going to turn off the light so there were no other cues. And then, after that big buildup, the researchers gave these volunteers chocolate yogurt instead of strawberry. And 19 of 32 people said that this was a yummy strawberry yogurt. And one of the volunteers said that strawberry yogurt was her favorite flavor, but this new flavor was better than the one she used to eat. She was going to switch right away.
Chocolate? I mean, I could understand if you said apricot versus strawberry.
Right. It was remarkable to get away with chocolate. Again, the people who made that mistake, the mistake wasn't that they didn't know enough. It was that they knew plenty. They knew an awful lot about strawberry. And when the experimenter said, here's some strawberry yogurt coming your way, they had so many associations that the associations drowned out the taste.
So what should we take away from all of this?
Be careful, for one thing. We're easy to fool. It's just a hard thing to avoid. That's part of the human predicament.
Edward, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Edward Dalnick is author of the book The Forger's Spell. His piece called Fish or Fowl appeared in the September 2nd, 2008 issue of the New York Times. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Groucho Marx. He said, "The secret of life is honesty and fair dealing." Now, if you can fake that, you have got it made.
The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room and Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, information on everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find invaluable newsletters and podcasts, you'll also find information on our new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. It's a collection of some of our favorite no-fail recipes, trench and tips, and stories from some of our favorite guests. You can check it all out online, splendidtable.org. Our program is supported in part by the Oregon Wine Board, offering wines without the pretense. You can come see why Oregon is still a place where you can shake the winemaker's hand and see their commitment to creating fine and sustainable wines. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and the moments that matter most. People are talking about food, menus, and cooking at Gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Special thanks this week to John Frazee for his recording skills and sense of adventure, and to Stephanie Bittner and Mariko Clark of the Oregon Wine Board for smoothing our way. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Thanks for listening. Please tune in next week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.